and welcome to episode 92 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
The performers we see on stage, in films, and on TV are much more diverse than they were just a few decades ago. But this welcome change doesn't mean there aren't still many questions about casting choices. Here are two examples. A letter writer recently asked the New York Times ethicist columnist about an upcoming community theater production in his city of Fiddler on the Roof, and whether it was okay to cast Gentiles in a play that showcases the Jewish experience. And colorblind casting is used in the hit Netflix series Bridgerton, which features a much more diverse cast than you might expect for a romantic drama set in 19th century England. Rick, when making casting decisions, what qualities, beyond, of course, acting skill, do you think it's appropriate to take into consideration?
That's such a broad question because it really depends on the production, what the aims of the production are, and then what kinds of qualities are needed to be able to give a convincing portrayal of a character. So you take something like The Princess Bride. If you're going to cast somebody in the role of the giant, well, then Andre the Giant makes a good set. Well, you know, it's not because he was a great actor. It's because he was so huge. And he also did, a pretty good job of acting.
But Danny DeVito would have been a less good choice.
Right. Unless you're trying to do some kind of experimental theater stuff where you're playing with, say, irony and you're playing against type, all those sorts of things. I mean, so that's another kind of choice. But so often you have certain goals that you're trying to accomplish, an effect you're trying to produce, and how can you produce it? And acting skill is only one of like many, many qualities you would take into account. And interestingly, like most of those qualities will have to do with appearance. That is, how is the character portrayed? How do they come across?
Sometimes if it's in a play, for example, is really important because that, like, you know, Andre the Giant's on a, not, that's Princess Bride is in a play, but that's one, but one example. And sometimes it's sort of not important at all.
No, and that's why you can have, oftentimes there's productions that have, for example, a very minimalist set where you're using your imagination to kind of fill in all the context and the background. Or you might have a Shakespearean drama that's played with people in contemporary street clothes, you know, so you play around those things, but that's all determined by kind of the aim of the production.
But using the example that the New York Times had, and we'll certainly link to it in the show notes, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, which I'm sure is a very commonly portrayed musical in community theaters across this country, is really about this Jewish family. And there's a lot of parts of this country where if you had an open casting call, you may not get, just because of the makeup of your community, may not have many Jewish people show up. Is that a problem in your mind?
I don't see it being a problem, and unless there's other social ends that you're trying to achieve with the casting. And I think that's what goes into so much of the call for, you know, for a very diverse cast right now, even in roles where they're depicting some kind of events that would not have been diverse, say, historically.
Mm-hmm.
We have other kinds of social ends. So like we know that there's been a history of discrimination with all kinds of work. So we want to make sure we have diverse representation among different kinds of professions. Well, like in the acting jobs, that means that you're going to have to take some liberties. I don't know if we should say take, it's not really taking liberties with it. Just like change the aim of the production to accommodate social ends as well as some of the other more traditional aims of theater or movies.
You know, recently, and it got some note, Denzel Washington starred as Macbeth in The Tragedy of Macbeth. And obviously Shakespeare did not write that for a black actor. And I'm not tremendously familiar with that production, but I think that, you know, we all know Denzel Washington is an A-list actor and could play that role well. Is that okay? I mean, even though it wasn't written for, I think it probably is, right?
Well, so what are you trying to do? Are you trying to use the play Macbeth, you said, or Hamlet?
Macbeth. Yeah.
So are you trying to use the play as historical drama where you're teaching history lessons, or are you using it to convey something about like the greatness of Shakespearean language and plotting and the story he tells? Well, then Denzel Washington is going to be better than just about anybody else you could get mm-hmm. at achieving many of those goals. And we all understand that if you're like, that's a really well-known play, you're not trying to teach history by putting on that play. You're trying to convey certain kinds of dramatic lessons and something, and I would say something about the eloquence of the language. And so, yeah, like Denzel Washington is a great choice. I would want to see that.
And although it's not the only example of this, it's probably the best known right now is the show Bridgerton, which is kind of a series on Netflix. They take different snippets of the story and make a season on each. And it is, I guess, really kind of colorblind casting where it's set in, you know, Regency England in the early 19th century, but you have people of all races portraying these things. And some people say, and we'll try to link to some examples of this in the show notes, but some people say this is great because it shows that we're not limiting who can play these roles. And this is opening these parts up to everybody and showing the audience a much more diverse cast. And that's all good. There are other people, however, who say that, and again, for those who haven't seen Bridgerton, it's a lot of things, but the conflict does not really come around race at all. That's just not part of the discussion. And there are some people say because of that, it gives a really false view of what that era looked like. Because if you happen to be a black person in that era, you were not treated like is depicted on that show. It was a much, much tougher life for you. And in some ways, it sort of scrubs that racist past that clearly was there. And I guess I could argue both sides of that. And I'd be curious what your thoughts are.
I have a hard time taking that kind of objection very seriously because it's not a serious show. It's mm-hmm. a soap opera.
Yeah, that's right? True. Yeah, yeah.
It's just goofy. There's all kinds of things that are historically inaccurate about it. And so you can't just take one of them and say, you know, like this is giving a false depiction of history because it's not showing the race relations realistically. There's all kinds of things that aren't realistic. And so like, it's just fantasy. It's a soap opera fantasy. And so like, okay, just put it into that category and stop thinking that people are going to take real lessons from it about what the history was like. But that's different, I think, than when you have a serious historical drama.
So staying on Netflix for a moment, The Crown has been a long series and obviously it's coming to its conclusion. But if in the, and for those who aren't familiar, because it's stretched over many, many decades, every couple seasons, they're sort of forced to recast the show because of the big jumps in age people take. It sounds like you think it would have been a really odd choice had they cast a black woman as, for example, Queen Elizabeth, because this is a show that does try to hew pretty close to what happened, or at least says it does. And that would seem jarring, I suppose, right?
It would be jarring, but also if like one of the points is to convey a sense of historical accuracy, that would be jarring because of that, because what you're trying to do with the show is in conflict with the nature of the representation. But this all depends on how seriously the social ends of creating a more fair and diverse society with opportunities for everybody, regardless of race or appearance, how important that is within the industry. And so you'd have to say, well, if you're going to have a show like this, where we say because of the historical depictions, we're only going to be able to hire white actors to portray these roles, do we have enough in all of our productions to give opportunities, like genuine opportunities for everybody? And so I think there's that kind of balancing question to ask, because of course there are social goals along with the kind of more limited roles of each production.
Just to stick with The Crown for a moment, again, they made the choice, the producers of that show, they announced this, I think, from the very beginning, that they're going to cover the Queen's life from the time she was, when she became Queen, I think she was in her 20s, till, we know how it ends. And that's a long time. And they, again, made the decision to cast three separate women in three different periods of their lives to better represent the Queen's evolution and age. They could have, I suppose, said, we're just going to cast Claire Foy, who was the Queen for the first two seasons, and hire the best makeup people we know and make her sit in a chair for 3 hours before shooting as she gets older and portray that all along. And I guess the question is, does that somehow take away roles for older, experienced women that you're like, oh, we're just going to take Claire Foy, who I don't know, she's probably in her 30s maybe, and saying, you know, and how can, and I think we can kind of unpack this in a number of different ways, but some people would say, how can Claire Foy understand what it's like to be an 80-year-old woman? Why not find someone who's much closer to that age? And oh, by the way, 80-year-old actresses aren't, you know, having the opportunity to turn away many jobs. So why not find someone who is in that part of their lives? Is how much of that should be taken into account, whether it's a big production like The Crown or like a community theater production where you should be, if you have a role of a 75-year-old woman, that you should do your darndest to find a 75-year-old woman, because that's just like helps you better capture what that character is like.
Yeah, if you have somebody like that, that's say a 75-year-old woman who has great insight, is also a really good actor and can portray it well, great. But if you have like a 60-year-old woman who with a little bit of makeup can give a much more convincing performance of the 75-year-old woman, then as the director, you probably want to go with that, right? I mean, this is all about what is the goal of the production. And I think otherwise, they'll like do different actors with different kinds of background and different kind of identity makeups, do they all have chances and opportunities? That is something really to get negotiated kind of behind the scenes, I think, like you would do within any other kind of job. Because look, there's all, you start down that road, you're not going to have kind of equal representation within each production of all the different kind of demographics within society. I mean, like Marvel pictures really discriminate against, you know, middle-aged, chubby, bald people.
Mm-hmm.
Like none of them get cast in any of those roles. Well,
or they get, you know, get killed in the first time they're on the screen.
Yeah. They're like, is that, but they aren't
wearing the suits and saving the day.
Right. And so there's always a kind of discrimination that takes place because it's portrayal and where, and you know, and what are the goals of the story. And so here's an example where that social pressure works to change it. You know, one of the longest running series in British television is Midsummer Murders. I think it's going on 20 seasons and something like 20 or 30 episodes a season or something. I mean, it's a very long running. You know, for the first, I don't know, 10 to 15 years, it was pretty much all white people in every role. And if you look at the last few years of the production, they've got a much more diverse cast. Well, that comes out of social pressure, and it doesn't make the show worse. It's something that happens as a kind of negotiation of the kind of the social ends of the these television shows as a product,
but you say,
and as a business.
But you say they, well assumed they did feel some social pressure to diversify the cast. And this isn't a show I'm familiar with, but I mean, that's certainly not the only one like that. Some people would say, and I think I didn't even read past the headline, I'll admit, that there was the new Indiana Jones movie is out with Harrison Ford, who's an old man now, but I'm sure doing heroic things. And the headline I read said, and I'm paraphrasing, but the new Indiana Jones movie is full of a bunch of woke signaling. And I don't know. I didn't read beyond the headline, so I don't know if it was what was said or the casting or sort of the topics that were included. But when you said that this show, this British show, had maybe due to some societal forces decided to diversify its cast, are you saying that that's good because it's more reflective of the audience who's watching that show? Or do you feel those pressures are misguided in some way?
No, I don't think they're really misguided. I think they're just a reflection of the way our society is changing and demanding more equal opportunities and inclusivity for people. The issue with the woke messaging, I think that is the response of one critic apparently to the Indiana
Jones. So you've heard this too?
Yeah, I've just seen it. I don't know anything about it. Yeah. So I'm just speculating, but there is a lot. It bothers me when movies that are trying to tell a story and really be entertainment are using it through the script and through the plot construction and so forth, really trying to send a social message. I just dislike it. I mean, I don't find it very entertaining. And so I understand that. But I think that the pressures to diversify the cast, I would put that in a different category than using an entertainment to put different kind of social pressures on the audience.
I'm going to take us down a little bit of a detour here, and I promise to get back to the topic at hand. But we were talking a little bit about age and whether it's appropriate to cast men or women in ages that are appropriate to the role they're playing. And as we were talking about that, it made me think of a discussion I saw online the past couple of weeks. As I think most listeners know, Martha Stewart made a bit of news recently. She was the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition. She is 81 years old. I think two things are probably true. I think for being 81, she looks really pretty good. And I also think that photo was retouched a little bit. And I think that's fine. I think some people have the impression that it's great that somebody with the stature of Martha Stewart and the life she's lived feels comfortable doing something like that. And it shows that you don't have to be, I mean, she doesn't have the body of your, you know, she, I mean, I don't want to, I'm not trying to shame her, but she does not have the body of your typical 23-year-old supermodel, and that you wouldn't expect her to. But isn't it good that someone of that age can, you know, have that opportunity? And then some people say that it is entirely unrealistic to expect any other 81-year-old to look that way, and we're just continuing to perpetuate these unrealistic images of what it means to be a woman or a person of a certain age. And I don't know if you have an opinion on this, but as we were talking about age, it just made me go down this detour for a moment.
Yeah, you know what? I don't have an opinion about it. I really don't. I really don't care. I mean, it's not going to make me go out and buy the issue. And I wouldn't buy it if she wasn't on it, if somebody else was on the issue. I have a hard time getting too worked up over the portrayals of people in these kinds of roles. Maybe they have a little bit of influence on society and shaping society and attitudes and so forth. I think they're largely superficial, so I don't get worked up over it.
And just to kind of pivot back to where we were is, yeah, maybe Martha Stewart appearing on that doesn't have a large societal impact. But do you think it does have a societal impact? You'd mentioned the Marvel movies. Yeah, they're not going to be any middle-aged fat guys as in the starring role. But I think Marvel has done people of different ethnicities, and things like that do can make a difference, don't you think? Or do you think that some of that's overblown?
No, I think it can. So like it makes a real world difference in that you're opening up job opportunities on a more equal basis, mm-hmm. right? So that's a real world difference. And then there's the public perception, because what you're trying to do is say, look, in some ways, put forth an idea of the, like, this is the kind of world we want, in which we're used to seeing a quite diverse world with opportunities, so that, you know, young people see themselves in different kinds of roles. I just don't see, you know, it's like something like the swimsuit issue and including, you know, a celebrity as she gets older and saying this opens the door to more acceptance of old people. Like, that's not going to happen. I know that that's kind of been argued as one of the mm-hmm. justifications. Mm-hmm. I think it's a rationalization, like people trying to make reasons, you know, for something that's really about kind of it's more public exposure for Martha and more money. And, you know, so it's in her interest to do it. And yeah, she wants to do it fine.
And maybe 80-year-olds are the only people who buy magazines still.
That could be.
Going back to the debate here we were chatting about, and I think one of the sort of longer standing discussions around casting and decisions is around LGBT characters. And there have been a lot of discussion over the years whether it's appropriate to have a straight actor portray someone who's gay. And I think the reason sometimes that people have a problem with that, or some of the things we've discussed in the show, is one, you're taking opportunities away from gay performers who might not otherwise have had those opportunities. And secondly, that it somehow makes them less relatable because they can't quite understand what it's like to be gay because they're not gay. And although I certainly understand it's important, like you said earlier, to open up opportunities to everyone, you know, be it race or gender or any other category, as someone who's gay, I just think that if you're an actor, you're naturally putting yourself into a role that's not you. And whether, you know, I don't think we should only hire people who are assassins to portray people who are assassins. I think you have to understand what that's about and maybe try to get into that character as best you can and try to be convincing to the audience. And I think the same thing can be said for a straight performer portraying someone on screen or on stage who's gay. And that's sort of my take on it. I'm just curious what yours is as well.
I agree with you completely. And if you go down the rabbit hole of controversies about these kinds of portrayals, you'll find a lot of talk about authenticity, like who can give an authentic portrayal of somebody. And like you have to have the identity of the person you're portraying in order to be authentic in that role. And I think it's all nonsense. You know, when Tom Hanks is in the movie Philadelphia, he gives what many people thought was a really authentic portrayal because he's a really great actor. And it wouldn't have been more authentic if you had had a gay actor with less skill. It could have very well come across as less authentic. And so that's why, you know, you always have to be judging. And this is very different than race, which is often quite apparent, say, on the screen or on the stage, where sexual identity is not apparent in the same way. So it all has to do with the ability to portray the character. And that is really, that's not judged by what's going on inside the actor's head. That's judged by how it comes across to the viewer.
And we'll get to race in a second. But I think where it's a little fuzzier, at least for me, is if you're having a performer portraying someone who is transitioning, for example, or who has transitioned. That is, to me, a little different because It is more than just acting a certain way. There are some physical characteristics that could come into play. And to me, that just feels a little different.
Yeah. So then it's a question of how it comes across. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, depending on the production, there may be more or less room for creative freedom and input on the part of the actor in the role. And that's where something like having real life experience with what's being portrayed may make quite a big difference. But like historically, for example, if you were somebody in a Hitchcock film, you had no kind of autonomy as an actor at all. You said the script exactly, it was laid out and it was all plotted and so forth, you know. So that's why I find these discussions in the abstract to kind of be ridiculous. It's a matter of how it comes across, and that will change depending on the actual production. Like, and say, what is the relationship between the director and the actor in the role?
Before we go, I think we have to tackle sort of the obvious question here. You mentioned Tom Hanks as a perfect example. He did a great job in Philadelphia portraying a gay man, very convincing. Did he win an Oscar? Was he nominated for an Oscar? One of the two.
I don't remember.
He was honored.
Honored.
People thought a lot of his performance.
And that was fairly early in his career.
It was. And I think in some ways sort of showed Hollywood that he was not just some goofy guy, but could take more serious roles.
Because he had been in comic roles before that.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think everybody looks at that and says he did a great job. And again, that's fine. I don't think anybody, and I'm sure I can speak on behalf of Tom Hanks confidently here, that he would never take a role being a white man and pretending he's a black man. And, you know, we have a history in this country of white performers doing such things back at one period in our history. And that just doesn't happen now. And I think maybe we should just take a minute and discuss why Tom Hanks playing someone who's gay is very different than Tom Hanks playing someone who's black.
I think it's largely because the historical circumstances of blackface being used as a caricature of black characters on stage mainly, and also in some cases on film. So you had performers like Al Jolson who would darken their faces and then, you know, and then paint their lips white and to portray a black singer on the stage or on film. And this was done for comedic effect often all across the country. And it was really terrible. And so, but then we have the legacy of that. And so then quite rightly, people are very sensitive to portrayals that either intentionally or unintentionally would seem to caricaturize somebody of a different race. I don't know if we will get past that at some point. I think it's in some ways it's unfortunate because, you know, we have a long history in theater of people playing different gender roles. You know, mm-hmm. Shakespearean dramas at that point, you know, men were playing women's roles all the time.
Because women weren't on stage.
Because women weren't on stage. But you also, the theater is full of people who by their personality are really kind of interested in transgressing boundaries. And this, you know, like all kinds of social boundaries, kind of social norms and expectations and playing around with different character types and different identities. It's kind of what they do with the living, but it's also kind of what they're good at. We're in this situation where we say, okay, we really want this. This is what we expect of our of people who are entertainers to do. And yet there are certain boundaries you can't cross. So like all these ones are open for experimentation. And then here's a few on the side. You say like, no, you can't do that. And I think, you know, lots of times, especially comedians are always pushing at those where we draw the line, they're pushing up against that. And so we'll see what happens. But I think the difference between that, like why race is off limits for certain kinds of portrayal is a really historical effect of blackface theater.
Hey folks, Mike Whalen, owner of the Thunder Bay Grill. I want you to try one of my favorites from our menu next time you stop in. I love the Atlantic Salmon Fresca with roasted vegetables, feta cheese, and citrus butter. It's unforgettable. Another favorite is the walleye, blackened or pan-fried. Personally, I like it blackened. But I can't forget about Thunder Bay's jumbo crab-stuffed shrimp, Maryland lump crab meat, and roasted bacon. Either way, you can't go wrong with any of our seafood selections. See you soon. Thunder Bay Grill, I-80 and Brady Street, Davenport.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. And I'm going to just tell you what happened to a friend of mine. And she and I chatted a little bit afterward. And I'm just curious what you would do if you were my friend. She and I, I've known her for a very long time. We're good friends. She's about the same age as I am, early 50s. And she had had this nagging pain in like her hip and leg, and it was just giving her trouble. So she went and had it, you know, went to a couple doctors, and finally a doctor said to her, you know, you're really young for this, I understand, but we think after reviewing the x-rays and the tests that you're a candidate for a hip replacement. And hip replacements aren't nearly as bad as they used to be. I've known people who have had them, but still, I mean, you don't want to have that. And you also feel like it's sort of like a stigma of like, I'm an old woman, and she's not. So, but she's like, well, if that helps get rid of this pain, she thought, that's what I'm going to do. But at the same time, she also thought that she wanted to get a second opinion. So she went to another specialist. May have been another health organization. I'm not truly sure. And this person, again, I don't know if he reviewed the same tests or he did some of his own, but said, actually, and I'm not going to explain this exactly right, but we think what's wrong is that you just have, I think it's some scar tissue or some other buildup in the hip area that we can go in. And I think the verb is like scrape out somehow, but it's like much less invasive, the recovery time is much quicker, of course it costs less, all those are good things, and we really think that this is what the problem is. So she's like, well, I want to, that sounds like a good idea, let's try that. So she goes and has that procedure done, and I chat with her not long after, and I said, how are you doing? And she's like, well, I mean, she's like, the recovery on this thing was minimal. She says, I'm already feeling so much better. I am just as confident as I can be that I made the right choice. So great. So this is probably, again, says the wrong things about me, but the question I had for her was, so are you going to go back and talk to that first doctor who just reflects, maybe not reflexively, but said, oh, I want to give you a full hip replacement, when we're pretty sure that, you know, option, what was behind curtain number two, was the right call. If it were me, I would be very tempted to make an appointment and after I'm feeling fine and saying, so remember that hip replacement you wanted to do? Let's talk about that. And why did you think that? And why did you not consider this? And put him on the spot a little bit. And so the question I have for you is, and I'll tell you, I'm fantastically lucky that I've had very little interaction with our healthcare system, not because it's a bad healthcare system, but because I just haven't needed to. So that's great. So maybe this happens a lot more than I think. But we all hear stories about you go to a hotel and the hotel room is a mess or it's dirty and you call the front desk and ask for a different room, or you get a meal that's not cooked well and you ask for, you know, a reduced price, or all these sort of smallish ticket things. But on something that's like much more important, again, this is a life-threatening. I don't want to overstate it, but it was important to her, and certainly yep. We can understand that. Should we be doing more to hold those healthcare providers accountable, or does that happen a lot more than I think it does?
I don't know about hold accountable so much, because we're not really in possession of a great deal of knowledge. You've got one incident here. You don't know all the facts involved. It could turn out that, like she ends up having like really good. She's symptom free for a few months or for a year or two, and then she starts having the problems again. She would have been better off to have one procedure and just replace the hip right then. There's a lot we don't know.
Yeah, that's true. Right? That's true.
And that's often the case when it comes to medical procedures. We're in possession of some of the information. We have a certain perspective on it, but healthcare providers might be seeing something very different that we're not aware of. But still, this seems to me like something that it depends. So depends on your goal. Like if you just want to go because it's going to make you feel better, to tell that darn doctor that he made a mistake and he shouldn't have, you know, suggested hip replacement. Or if what you really are concerned about is that, you know, other patients might be coming along and getting unnecessary procedures from this doctor.
That too.
If you're concerned about that, then you would say, okay, what approach is going to be most persuasive? What approach would the doctor be likely to listen to? And it probably wouldn't be you showing up for an appointment saying, remember that hip replacement you told me I needed?
Look at the dance I can do now.
Right, right. So in a case like that, I would say, well, I think you should write a letter and start out thanking the letter for advice. Say, well, after getting another opinion, I decided to go this route. And so far, the results have been really good. And I just thought you might want to know, you know, something like that. But you'd want to phrase it in such a way that you're not trying to get back. You're not trying to blame. It's just informative. And phrase it as politely as possible, because we know this about human nature. People shut down in response to criticism. So if you really want to have a, you know, better influence for the sake of future patients of that doctor, you want to be as persuasive as you can.
And I think what she decided to do, and I think this would be much more on your side of the ledger, is, you know, any of these sort of processes start with your general practitioner.
Yeah.
And so she asked her general practitioner to inform, I'll call him Dr. Number One, saying, well, just so you know, this patient decided to get a second opinion. And because I think maybe, and I don't know if this is what my friend was thinking, but doctors can talk about, you know, have their own sort of language about these things and can explain things better than a patient and a doctor could. So that was the approach or the angle she took.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that sounds like a really good approach. But the more confrontational you are, the less effective you are in cases like that.
But you would argue that whether it's something like this or whether it's something like you check into the Hilton and the bathroom's filthy, that's also the approach you would take about something like that and not go down to the front desk with pictures on your phone and saying, how could you possibly let someone stay in this room? Look at this bathtub and look at this shower. You would instead do what?
Yeah, I would say they probably have a place for complaints or something like that. And I would just say, inform you, you know, you may not know. So lots of times, now sometimes there's people who are really negligent. They're not just not doing their job. But other times, I mean, you've got people's attention is being pulled in all kinds of way and they're short-staffed and, you know, and they're really grateful to find out that there's something that's causing a problem that they haven't been notified about. And so you'd be as pleasant as possible. I'll tell you what about dirty bathrooms. I had somebody come down to my office one time in a building where I teach and come down to my office. This is when the building was only about a year old and said, oh, the bathroom is disgusting. There's these cobwebs that are hanging on the wall. I mean, I couldn't even stay in the bathroom. It was so filthy. I had to go out and go to a different building to use the bathroom. And I was thinking, that sounds really strange. And I went in there and there's a kind of a spider webby effect on the tile. Just an appearance. It was perfectly clean, but like she came to me complaining and she was really upset and saying like, you've got to tell the custodians that they're not doing their job and all this. She was convinced that there was a real problem. And like, this is one of the things, like the more angry you get about things like this, the more you are often looked at just being, you're a wacko. Like you can get your complaint dismissed.
So under the category of probably being a wacko, and before we go, I'll tell you my wacko hotel story. So, and we haven't done this in a few years, but there was this particular hotel we like to stay at in a particular city, and there was a particular room area of the hotel I liked, because it actually, it was like four stories up, so you were away from the noise, but you could overlook the pool, but you were like far enough away to not have the pool noise. So I thought it was like a great place. And we often stayed there around Christmas time, and it was a really quiet time. So you used to kind of, you could usually pick your time, your room. So I think I even chose it online, and I got the key, and I went down there, and I it was just not the room. So I'm like, I went back and said, oh, I'm sorry. I like there was some confusion. I really wanted one of those fourth floor rooms that overlooks the pool. And then the guy, and it wasn't especially busy at the counter, but the guy's like, well, I'm sorry, none of the fourth floor rooms overlook the pool. I'm like, well, no. I mean, I've stayed here a few times. I know they do. And we went back and forth. And I said, finally, do you have like a map of your hotel that shows the rooms? And he finally brought it out. And I said, well, and look, there's the fourth floor. And so he did admit that, yes, he did. There was a fourth floor rooms that overlooked the pool. And at that point, I should have probably let it go. But I did tell him that if he had any other questions about the hotel, he could certainly call my room and I would be happy to fill him in. But I had stayed there a few times. That's not the approach you would recommend.
No, but that's sounds like really, it would fit really well into certain kinds of sitcoms. So,
but I mean, I just knew, and like the whole time I was so worried that like,
he just denied.
Wrong?
He said, no, we don't, we don't have a fourth floor at this hotel.
Well, they had a fourth floor, but he was just convinced that those rooms did overlook the pool. And again, I'm like 99% sure. And I was like, oh my gosh, what if I'm embarrassed? And well, thank goodness.
Was he lying because he didn't want to take the trouble to move you?
No,
or he
no,
really
I,
didn't know?
No, I truly think he just didn't know. And I mean, yeah, okay. I've done things like that. I mean, we've all made comments like, I remember one time having a discussion that, no, we only have four drawers in our kitchen and we had five. You know, things like that, you just don't back down. But in this case, I was right. And He never did call the hotel room, though, to ask any other questions about his hotel. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.